Bitcoiners, welcome back to FedWatch. I hope you're liking all the shiny new bells and whistles around with our new rebrand. I'm really excited for what we're about to bring out for you guys. But today we are going to bring you a much needed update and just complete walkthrough this year's annual Jackson Hole meeting. This is a really big Fed-related meeting every single year. It's extremely important, and we break down the most important part and give you the analysis for it. So before we get into it, though, I guess, Ansel, why don't you kind of give a little bit more context for maybe some of the Bitcoiners who are unaware of Jackson Hole and kind of like the type of people that attend this meeting and what is the purpose?
Yeah, so Jackson Hole is a symposium put on by the Kansas City Fed every year at this time. And it started as like an agricultural thing. So obviously Kansas City is in the Midwest. And so it was really focused around agriculture until I think it was the late 1970s or early 1980s. It became more of a central banker meetup. So they get together every year in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and they talk about all their different monetary policies, probably synchronizing monetary policy around the world. And yeah, so this year it was virtual again. 2020 was virtual. This year was virtual. The Fed wanted to do it in person, but apparently the hotel where they hold it at every year, they actually said that they weren't going to have guests there. I don't know why, but so they held it virtually, and which is kind of good because now we get to see Jerome Powell's speech, and it was much anticipated for many different reasons, mainly because everyone thought he was going to be talking about taper. And so we will get into that today.
Awesome. Well, I mean, again, people have been talking about taper. The virtual setting, it kind of does make me feel better because at least these guys aren't getting together and vacationing in beautiful Jackson Hole just because, like, they don't deserve that. And especially during a pandemic, yeah, stay on Zoom, whatever. But that's just my bias. I mean, should we get into this first clip or do you want to intro it?
Well, my intro here is obviously we've dissected Jay Powell in the past. And we have said that he is somewhat of a straight shooter when it comes to central bank chair people. So like Christine Lagarde, when she speaks, you just get this very dishonest aura around her or feeling when she's speaking. A lot of other central bankers are like that. But I think Powell, you don't get that same feeling. He's somewhat of a straight shooter. And my take, this show is contrarian in that we're not on the hyperinflation bandwagon, at least I'm not. And I think that we are trying to provide like a synthesis between Austrian economics and real hard world, real data from around the market and look at what the central bankers are saying and see if it matches up. So that's kind of my intro for this.
Okay. And just again, to set the context, this is Jerome Powell's much awaited speech from this Fed conference, this central bankers conference. And let's just get into this first clip.
Strong policy support has fueled a vigorous but uneven recovery, one that is, in many respects, historically anomalous. In a reversal of typical patterns in a downturn, aggregate personal income rose rather than fell, and households massively shifted their spending from services to manufactured goods. Booming demand for goods and the strength and speed of the reopening have led to shortages and bottlenecks, leaving the COVID-constrained supply side unable to keep up. The result has been elevated inflation in durable goods, a sector that has experienced an annual inflation rate well below zero over the past quarter century.
There, the things I want to point out is that it is interesting that this was an anomalous kind of recession, that income did rise because of all of the stimulus payments to people. And he gets into that later on even more about how the rising incomes during a recession had this a big effect on the economy. And they can explain so much that's going on with shortages on the supply side and all of that. Do you have any comments on that first section, Christian?
No, I mean, it was interesting to hear him talk about it being uneven, right? That's kind of how he started it, and that this was an anomaly. So I'm curious to what he's going to say next, to be honest.
The unevenness of the recovery can further be seen through the lens of the sectoral shift of spending into goods, particularly durable goods such as appliances, furniture, and cars, and away from services, particularly in-person services in areas such as travel and leisure. As the pandemic struck, restaurant meals fell 45%, air travel 95%, and dentist visits 65%. Even today, with overall GDP and consumption spending more than fully recovered, services spending remains about 7% below trend. Total employment is now 6 million below its February 2020 level, and 5 million of that shortfall is in the still depressed service sector. In contrast, spending on durable goods has boomed since the start of the recovery and is now running about 20% above the pre-pandemic level. With demand outstripping pandemic-afflicted supply, rising durables prices are a principal factor lifting inflation well above our 2% objective. Given the ongoing upheaval in the economy, some strains and surprises are inevitable. The job of monetary policy is to promote maximum employment and price stability as the economy works through this challenging period.
Okay, so there he laid out these sectoral shifts, and I can share my screen because that chart that he showed was kind of brief. So I'm going to share this. The top line here is the services spending, and you can see during the pandemic, it crashed and has not returned to trend. Okay, but the durable spending has, because everybody, the service people in travel, all travel was shut down, hotels, restaurants, all of these service industries were shut down. And so people weren't spending, obviously, and they still have not recovered to trend. However, they got the stimulus, they had an increased income, the average income increased, and people still went out and spent, but they spent it on manufactured goods, durable goods that needed to go through a supply chain. Well, if all the supply chains are shut down as well because of COVID, you know, that's just going to become a huge shortage. And it is still significantly above the trend. So even today, service spending is down, but manufactured goods spending is up. And so that, even when the supply chains aren't back to normal yet. So we can see how this would affect prices in general, right? Because there's more money chasing fewer manufactured goods. Any thoughts on that, Christian?
I mean, it seems accurate. Again, like people have been speculating about what's behind all of this, you know, lumber increases, just the massive increases in commodities and stuff like that. So this analysis seems to make sense.
Okay. There was something else I wanted to add in here, and that was, okay, so they started talking about the monetary policy is about price stability and maximum employment. And I just wanted to point that out here. He goes into a little bit more in depth, but before he does that, I mean, how well have they done on that? Obviously, employment is horrible and stable prices are horrible, but they are going to, their monetary policy has been pretty much the same. And that's kind of a theme here that I want to kind of build on, is that they haven't changed their monetary policy, but the data has changed and shifted. They've missed the boat. They were late to the party. They didn't see this coming. And they were piss poor at what they did. Yet they think now they can just set and forget and let their monetary policy continue because they have long-term targets. I mean, they can't even hit a short-term target. How do they think they're going to hit a long-term target?
No, I mean, and I think that that's great criticism. And, you know, something that you, Parker Lewis, many others, Jeff Snyder, have made is just these people do not know what they're doing. I've heard the analogy, driving with a fogged up front windshield, looking in the rearview mirror at the damage that you're doing and trying to course correct. Like, they don't know what they're doing. And again, like, how much of the economy have they manipulated? And then what are the results? What's the results of their activity? Unemployment is lower and prices are unstable, even though income has gone up, right? So they pumped our bags up, they created inequality, and guess what? Results suck. Whoop-de-doo, right? Why do we keep doing this? I don't know. But let's keep watching, right?
The spike in inflation is so far largely the product of a relatively narrow group of goods and services that have been directly affected by the pandemic and the reopening of the economy. The durable goods alone contributed about 1% to the latest 12-month measures of headline and core inflation. Energy prices, which rebounded with the strong recovery, added another 0.8% to headline inflation. And from long experience, we expect the inflation effects of these increases to be transitory. In addition, some prices, for example, for hotel rooms and airplane tickets, declined sharply during the recession and have now moved back up close to pre-pandemic levels. The 12-month window we use in computing inflation now captures the rebound in prices, but not the initial decline, temporarily elevating reported inflation. These effects, which are adding a few tenths to measured inflation, should wash out over time. We consult a range of measures meant to capture whether price increases for particular items are spilling over into broad-based inflation. These include trimmed mean measures and measures excluding durables and computed from just before the pandemic. These measures generally show inflation at or close to our 2% longer-run objective. We would be concerned at signs that inflationary pressures were spreading more broadly through the economy. We are also directly monitoring the prices of particular goods and services most affected by the pandemic and the reopening, and are beginning to see a moderation in some cases as shortages ease. Used car prices, for example, appear to have stabilized. Indeed, some price indicators are beginning to fall. If that continues, as many analysts predict, then used car prices will soon be pulling measured inflation down, as they did for much of the past decade.
So, a lot of excuses, Ansel, and a lot of redefining what inflation is. That's what I took from that. I want to hear your analysis.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Well, he's trying to describe the limitations of the CPI. The CPI comes in two kind of flavors, year over year and month over month. And obviously, month over month makes sense. So prices were 0.5% higher in June than in May or something like that. But the year over year is a little bit harder to understand. So that is just the prices last June compared to this June. And when you're dealing with a 12-month window, and I brought this up when we talked about CPI in the past, or at least on my newsletters, I've said this, is that, you know, the damage to the economy really happened in March and April. And so once you go past those 2 months, then the year over year data does not take into account the big drop. So what he's saying is that this summer in June and July and August, we are getting this year over year that doesn't include the big drop. And that chart that they showed, I'm going to share my screen one more time. Chart that they showed here is an 18-month window instead of a 12-month window. And so they're including the big drop at the beginning of the pandemic back in March, you know, February, March, and April. They're including those bad months. And if they include those bad months, it's right around their 2% target, right? And so over time, what he's saying is that as the initial good months that followed those really bad months, as those good months kind of trail off as well, then the inflation numbers will level out. So that was just kind of more of an explanation of what he's trying to say. Do you have any comments on that?
Ultimately, what he's really saying is we didn't know, we still don't really know, and we think it will get better, but we're not sure. Like, he just said that very eloquently with some nice visuals, essentially. And they're manipulating these visuals in order to tell the story they want. And they're manipulating the variables to tell the story that they want. But the reality is the government reaction destroyed supply chains. People were incentivized to do what they're incentivized to do. And that put things in haywire. And guess what? You weren't controlling them then. You're still not controlling them now. And the most that you're doing is you're just adding more inputs into this system that is a complex system that you do not control. That's the most you're doing. But ultimately, you just don't know. So I know I'm ranting. We've been talking about this for over a year, you know, and it's just ludicrous watching them a year later admit that they didn't know, but at the same time persist as if they can know or they will know now or moving forward, granted this learning, right?
Right. Yeah, and my big thing is that the big problem with all of this analysis is on the definition of inflation. You know, how is supply chains, how are, you know, shortages, how is that money printing, right? And so a lot of Bitcoiners and a lot of sound money people and Austrian economists, they are really honed in on this debasement and money printing aspect. But really, we can see just in the first half of his speech here and some of his charts, a lot of this is just due to supply chain stuff. And so how is supply chain money printing? And that's why we need to really hone in on the exact definition of inflation in my mind. I wanted to show my screen again and show some of these things that he talked about. So this is the used car index. And you can see, I don't know if it's clear, but down here is 2020, January 2020. And that's right when it dropped February. And it's skyrocketed since then. So the prices have, you know, used cars obviously have been a big factor in the CPI. And just recently, it has started coming down. So that effect will be felt in some of the numbers. I have some more things here I wanted to share. So let's go to this one first, which is the commodities index. This is a monthly chart. So each candle is a month. And if we zoom into the last year, yes, it has been pretty much straight up. Right. But if you zoom out and you look at since the great financial crisis, the trend has been pretty much down. And if you look at these dates in here, 2011 to 2015, commodities as a commodity index was much, much higher. I want to break this down too, because a lot of people have been saying this, that inflation is like we've seen with a 5% increase recently, right, in recent CPI numbers. And they say, oh, well, inflation only goes up. It never goes down. That's why it's not transitory. The inflation effect is going to always be felt. The prices are now permanently higher. But when you look at these things like commodities, no, they're not. They go up and they go down and they go up and they go down and they go up and they go down. But the trend is, since the great financial crisis in commodities, the trend is lower. Let's go to oil real quick. Obviously, oil is a big factor in the commodities index in general. So you see the same kind of pattern. And we see this from the great financial crisis lower. And just recently, we have this slight increase here. But I mean, we're talking $68 a barrel, where back in 2014, we were all the way up at $100 a barrel. So that's what, 50% higher or so than it is today. So prices go up and prices come down and prices go up and prices come down. It's transitory. What else we got? 10-year. I don't know what to say about that one. I wanted to show the gasoline prices. In the great financial crisis, it was at $4.15 a gallon. And since then, you know, it's touched $4 multiple times. And then in 2016, it dropped all the way down to 183, and just recently down to 187. And yes, we have seen a spike up recently here, but it is not nearly as high as it was back in after the great financial crisis. So prices go up and prices come down, transitory. That's all I got for that.
And again, like, if I could just jump in, like, I feel like you are hyper, hyper focused on, you know, what the charts are telling us, that kind of thing. And people are often saying, we are experiencing this bad thing. And then they assign inflation and money printing to it as an easy explanation, right? You know, I think my two cents would be, we have a opaque and not transparent financial system. No one knows what the hell is happening, and all the inputs are messed up. And that's why we need Bitcoin. That's how Bitcoin fixes this. If we were on the Bitcoin rails, that would not be an issue. And we probably could be able to actually make economic decisions. Like, here is the core problem. The whole world is using this terrible financial system, or this cobweb of terrible financial systems, in order to allocate resources, time, and human energy. So, and the experts, the utmost experts, have no effing idea how it works, yet they are trying to manipulate it. Not saying they're manipulating it in the way that they can actually control or get the results they want, because obviously they can't. Again, we've been through this already. You know, we just went through the last, you know, 10 minutes of listening to good old Jay, but they're still going to do it. And again, that's why we need Bitcoin. That's why we need to evolve to a better system. You know, if you're worried about how we're destroying the planet, how we're polluting the planet, all this kind of fear, you have to look at what incentivizes everyone to do their thing, right? And it's the money. And then who controls, or who thinks that they control, or who manipulates that? It's Jay over here and others. So all I have to say is, why Bitcoin? And I think your charts are interesting. just to show that there's more to it than under the surface. And, you know, I think that the conversation with Greg Foss and Aaron Segal went into a lot of that too, even though it was more geopolitical.
All right, Bitcoiners, I want to tell you about our newest sponsor. This show is brought to you by Ledin.io. I have been super, super impressed with the guys over at Ledin. I've actually known the co-founders, Adam and Maurizio, for a very long time. I've had the pleasure to watch them build Ledin up from a tiny, tiny startup to now a super impressive institutional grade Bitcoin and crypto lender. Y'all, I'm so impressed with these guys. They are offering some of the best rates out there. I don't think anyone even comes close to touching them. You can get 6.1% APY on your first two Bitcoin that you deposit into Ledin interest accounts, and you can get 8.5% on USDC deposits. I mean, I know all the competitors. They're not even close. If you're going to put your crypto and your Bitcoin into an interest account, Ledin is by far the best. And on top of that, like I said, these guys are hardcore Bitcoiners and they know the products and the services that Bitcoiners want and appreciate. They came up with B2X. It allows you to put your Bitcoin in, they leverage it up, and you can, with one click of the mouse, get twice the exposure to Bitcoin. So if you're super bullish, Ledin has you covered with a super, super easy way to get leverage with B2X. And then on top of that, they know that Bitcoiners care about your reserves. They know that Bitcoiners don't like under-reserved and not full-reserved financial institutions. So they are pushing the frontier in transparency in the digital asset lending space. And they are the first digital asset lender to do a full proof of reserves and proof of attestation through a Mariano LLC, a public accounting firm. So the Ledin guys, they know what Bitcoiners like. They are legit. I encourage you guys to check them out. Do your own research and go to Ledin.io. That is Ledin.io and learn more. Bitcoiners, I want to tell you about The Deep Dive. The Deep Dive is Bitcoin Magazine's premium market intelligence newsletter. This is a no-fluff, hard-hitting, incredible newsletter going deep into the market, helping you understand what's happening with derivatives, what's happening on-chain, what's happening in macro, what's happening with the narrative, and what's happening with the tech. My man, Dylan LeClaire, is an absolute savant. He is making his name known in the Bitcoin community, getting shout-outs left and right, getting on podcasts left and right, and him and his team are bringing you everything that you need to know about Bitcoin. You don't even have to be on Bitcoin Twitter. You can ignore every other newsletter. This is the newsletter to rule them all. Go over to members.bitcoinmagazine.com, sign up today. And if you use promo code MACRO, you get a full month for free. You have nothing to lose. What are you waiting for? Sign up, see the incredible work that Dylan and his team are putting out. And if you don't like it, just unsubscribe. You don't pay a dime. But if you do, you know, it's going to be well worth the sats in investment in understanding Bitcoin and gaining the confidence to continue to invest in Bitcoin and making the right moves around Bitcoin. And it's going to be well worth every single Satoshi. Again, can't recommend it enough. That is members.bitcoinmagazine.com, promo code MACRO. Do it today.
There's a lot to unpack. I know we have some more videos to get to, so I'll get off my soapbox.
Policymakers and analysts generally believe that as long as longer-term inflation expectations remain anchored, policy can and should look through temporary swings in inflation. Our monetary policy framework emphasizes that anchoring longer-term expectations at 2% is important for both maximum employment and price stability. We carefully monitor a wide range of indicators of longer-term inflation expectations. These measures today are at levels broadly consistent with our 2% objective. Because measures of inflation expectations are individually noisy, we also focus on common patterns across the measures. One approach to summarizing these patterns is the board staff's Index of Common Inflation Expectations, which combines information from a broad range of survey and market-based measures. This index captures a general move down in expectations starting around 2014, a time when inflation was running persistently below 2%. More recently, the index shows a welcome reversal of that decline and is now at levels more consistent with our 2% objective. Longer-term inflation expectations have moved much less than actual inflation or near-term expectations, suggesting that households, businesses, and market participants also believe that current high inflation readings are likely to prove transitory, and that in any case, the Fed will keep inflation close to our 2% objective over time. Finally, it is worth noting that since the 1990s, inflation in many advanced economies has run somewhat below 2%, even in good times. The pattern of low inflation likely reflects sustained disinflationary forces, including technology, globalization, and perhaps demographic factors, as well as a stronger and more successful commitment by central banks to maintain price stability. In the United States, unemployment ran below 4% for about 2 years before the pandemic, while inflation ran at or below 2%. Wages did move up across the income spectrum, a welcome development, but not by enough to lift price inflation consistently to 2%. While the underlying global disinflationary factors are likely to evolve over time, there is little reason to think that they have suddenly reversed or abated. It seems more likely that they will continue to weigh on inflation as the pandemic passes into history.
Okay, that was 1340. So my reaction to that initial point was, love your background now, Christian. People need to go onto YouTube and watch us there because we are laughing in the background and we have all of our screen shares and stuff going on. But my reaction to that is, again, they're talking about long-term inflation expectations. They want to anchor these long-term inflation expectations. And that is my contention of what they actually do. They set expectations. They don't print money. They don't have their monetary policy doesn't actually affect the economy other than they talk and jab and try to set these expectations for the market. So I did want to share my screen real quick again and look at that chart that he had. This one was interesting, and I'm not going to beat a dead horse here because everyone knows that I'm not in the big inflation camp, but this is a chart of major economies, not including the United States. And back in the 90s, I mean, if you put the United States on here, it would be roughly the same. Okay. And back in the 90s, when I was going through middle school and high school, that was like the last great growth period in the United States, and inflation expectations were much higher, okay, than they are today. And inflation was much higher. If you go back and look at all the statistics, inflation was much higher in the 80s and the 90s than it has been in the last decade. And this is all trending down. And lastly, I'll point out in this chart, starting in 2018, we see a kind of a spike. Everyone's going together. And that's when they said it was globally synchronized growth. You might have heard that term. Because as growth goes up, interest rates go up. Okay, that's what actually pushes interest rates up is growth. But that didn't last. And in 2019, late 2019, we saw a reversal of that before the pandemic hit. So this can start getting into since this was the shortest recession in history, the shortest and the deepest recession in history, are they just masking a lot broader trend to the downside, right? That started in 2019 and is continuing now in 2021, maybe into 2022 or something like that. Is that the real recession? And this pandemic blip was just kind of an excuse. So I'll stop there. And what do you got, Christian?
So, I mean, changed my background because I think exactly the place is on fire. Nothing is going well, but yet he can still point to a narrative where, oh, it's fine, right? We're on target long term. This is welcome inflation from the downward trend that we've been experiencing, which you have pointed out many times. Like, oh, thank God we have this inflation. We got it under control. Like, no, what's happening is the destruction in supply chains that have been happening is expedited significantly. And then you just rearranged wealth. You rearranged the numbers on the scoreboard. And then now society is going bonkers. Right? But it's fine. Long-term inflation expectations are correct. We are not deflating. The world is not becoming less productive and less efficient. We're not experiencing anything wrong. Ansel, I promise you, it's fine.
Yeah, exactly. They're trying to talk us into thinking that, hey, there's inflation coming, there's growth coming, but when there's nothing of the sort. So let's move on to the next segment. This is the last one. I know this is going on a little bit longer, but let's get into at minute 1712. That's where they really dive into this policy discussion. So that's a 2-minute clip.
The committee remains steadfast in our oft-expressed commitment to support the economy for as long as is needed to achieve a full recovery. The changes we made last year to our monetary policy framework are well-suited to address today's challenges. We have said that we would continue our asset purchases at the current pace until we see substantial further progress toward our maximum employment and price stability goals, measured since last December when we first articulated this guidance. My view is that the substantial further progress test has been met for inflation. There has also been clear progress toward maximum employment. At the FOMC's recent July meeting, I was of the view, as were most participants, that if the economy evolved broadly as anticipated, it could be appropriate to start reducing the pace of asset purchases this year. The intervening month has brought more progress in the form of a strong employment report for July, but also the further spread of the Delta variant. We will be carefully assessing incoming data and the evolving risks. Even after our asset purchases end, our elevated holdings of longer-term securities will continue to support accommodative financial conditions. The timing and pace of the coming reduction in asset purchases will not be intended to carry a direct signal regarding the timing of interest rate liftoff, for which we have articulated a different and substantially more stringent test. We have said that we will continue to hold the target range for the federal funds rate at its current level until the economy reaches conditions consistent with maximum employment and inflation has reached 2% and is on track to moderately exceed 2% for some time. We have much ground to cover to reach maximum employment, and time will tell whether we have reached 2% inflation on a sustainable basis.
Just to sum up what he said there, he said that progress was needed to do a taper. They have seen progress, continued to improve over and over again, month after month as they have been meeting, but he never said anything straight out that they will be tapering. So he said a taper in the easiest possible way without actually saying we're going to taper. That's what he said. He also said that interest rates are separate from that. If people follow the Fed and how they do the monetary policy, they will taper from $120 billion a month that they're quote unquote purchasing out assets, securities from the market. They'll taper that down to 110, 100, 80, 60, wean the market off. That's their plan at least. And then later on down the road, they will tackle the interest rate stuff. So Christian, what do you got?
Well, I mean, I don't know if he kind of like set up this false scenario for taper. If we can get maximum employment up, then, and we're starting to continue make progress, it will improve. You know, it's kind of based on this idea that coronavirus is the thing that is the cause of all of this problem. And prior to coronavirus, we were fine, right? And we already know that that is not the case. They started these repo purchases before coronavirus. We were not fine before coronavirus. So all the challenges that coronavirus and the logistical challenges and the political challenges that, you know, have emerged since, you know, that is just only further complications to the disaster that already existed. So I don't think that they're ever going to taper because, like, it's not politically palatable. And he pretty much said it gets to the point where we're looking good, we'll taper. But he pretty much set up a scenario that will never happen because we know that it's going to continue to slide in the opposite direction.
Yeah, he didn't want to commit to anything and then not be able to follow through. So yeah, I get that. He didn't touch on this whole time. He didn't touch on the entire 20-minute speech, the reverse repo issue. And I'll share my screen once again here. It continues to go up here, the reverse repo, and he didn't even talk about it once. The Fed is up to doing about $1.1 trillion every night in overnight repos, and it continues to go up. It does look like it might be slowing a little bit. And I also want to point out that an end of the quarter is coming up, and this is the biggest end of the quarter for banks and for governments. So this is the end of the U.S. fiscal year, banking fiscal year in September. So that is always a hot time for crises to happen. So back in 2019, I mean, almost every crisis that you can look at started something in September or October. So that this is the time frame. And maybe Powell is looking forward to September and October. He's like, man, I wish I could make this speech in late October instead of late August. But anyway, that's how it went, and he didn't want to commit to anything, I guess.
Bitcoiners, I am so excited to tell you about the Bitcoin 2022 conference. You guys, Bitcoin 2021 was absolutely a smash hit success. It was over 13,000 Bitcoiners coming together, breaking the barriers on who can come together and celebrate freedom, celebrate Bitcoin, and the energy was absolutely electric. Unfortunately, it was just oversubscribed. There's just people flowing out everywhere. And this year, we are learning. We are making the conference bigger and better. We are moving over to the Miami Beach Convention Center, and we are going to be throwing a massive four-day festival for Bitcoin, celebrating Bitcoin, bringing together the greatest minds in Bitcoin and the greatest businesses in Bitcoin. And lastly, the culture of Bitcoin all together. We have a four-day extravaganza planned for you guys for Bitcoin 2022. Day one is going to be industry day. It is a day where you can buy a special ticket in order to just mingle and make business deals happen. Day two and three is going to be a full-blown Bitcoin conference. This is our main conference. This is going to be on April 7th and 8th. And then lastly, we have the Sound Music Festival day four. Imagine going to Coachella, but for Bitcoin. There's going to be very few talks. It's going to be all about the culture of Bitcoin. It's going to be all about hanging with your fellow plebs. And it's going to be an absolutely amazing time. There's going to be Bitcoin musicians, Bitcoin artists, and all your favorite Bitcoiners, and just an amazing environment to party and just see it all, soak it all in, and to get people to realize that a Bitcoin world, a world filled with Bitcoin people doing Bitcoin things, is the world that they want to live in. That's what Bitcoin 2022 is all about. That is what the Bitcoin conference is all about. That's what Bitcoin Magazine is all about. So it is going to be a celebration of Bitcoin, the Bitcoiners, and this amazing movement that is going to make the world a better place. Go to b.tc/conference. Learn more about the Bitcoin conference. Learn more about all the amazing things that are happening in Miami around the Bitcoin conference and buy your tickets. And guess what? If you buy your tickets with Bitcoin, you save $100 on all the tickets and $1,000 on the whale pass. So if you want the VIP pass, the big kahuna, if you buy with Bitcoin, you save $1,000. That's a lot of sats. So go and do it right now today. Don't wait. Prices are only going up. This is going to be a can't miss event. Bitcoiners, let's take a break from the content. And I want to tell you about Coolbix. Coolbix is an awesome Bitcoin hardware wallet that's been around for a really long time. They are building an amazing Bitcoin wallet called the Cool Wallet Pro. The Cool Wallet Pro is state of the art Bitcoin hardware wallet technology. Its form factor is like a credit card. You can put it into your wallet and it is designed to go with you on the go. So that way, even when you're on the go, you can have the benefit of a two-factor hardware wallet design when you're trying to spend your Bitcoin. So you can have your Bitcoin wallet UX on your phone and make it really easy to scan, decide what you want to do, but then you sign with a Coolbit X, which is in your back pocket. It is tamper-proof. It is waterproof. It is flexible. It has an awesome secure element in it. And it is a really awesome way in order to have some more flexibility, yet security when you're taking your Bitcoin on the go. I personally am a fan of this idea of making Bitcoin into a medium of exchange and making it into something that people use. I know it's going to take time, but they are working on the UX for making that possible in as secure a way possible. So have some peace of mind. Check out the Cool Wallet Pro from Coolbix, and thank you to them for sponsoring this podcast.
Well, isn't the timing perfect for a traditional finance, traditional banking, government crisis right when Bitcoin's going to start really freaking heating up? So it seems like Satoshi knew, and the clockwork that he set Bitcoin on is impeccable. The timing is absolutely impeccable.
For sure. So that is the last of the Jackson Hole stuff, but there is more Powell news. If you want, we can cover that in probably 2 minutes here real quick. Okay. So Powell is coming up for reappointment, like we've said multiple times now on the show, and that is in February. It's starting to turn more and more political. So I'm going to once again share my screen, everybody. So subscribe on YouTube so you can see all this stuff. So we have AOC has come out. And really started putting pressure. AOC and her group of progressives, they're calling Biden to dump Powell as Fed chair. So their group wants Powell to be replaced, stepping up the pressure on President Joe Biden as he draws closer to decision on the government's most important economic post. They want to reshape the Fed. Quote, as news of the possible reappointment of Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell circulates, we urge President Biden to reimagine the Federal Reserve focused on eliminating climate risk and advancing racial and economic justice. We urge the Biden administration to use this opportunity to appoint a new Federal Reserve chair. I mean, it just continues to heat up. That's all I have for that. It continues to get more and more political with AOC and the progressives. Remember, we talked about Elizabeth Warren. Oh, I do have some other stories here from, I wanted to show this climate change is they're trying to push the Fed and central banks in general to be political entities, right? There's supposed to be this separation, at least in the United States, of political influence on the Federal Reserve. But they're trying to push this more and more in there, like we just read with the climate and the racial injustice and all that stuff. Back in 2019, the IMF was already talking about this, and I'll include all of these links in the show notes. So that the headline is Climate Change and Financial Risk. Then the Fed came out with something in March of this year, Climate Change and Financial Stability. And finally, the ECB has won Climate Change and Monetary Policy. So all of these headlines are very, very similar, and they have a similar idea that the central banks need to be political. They need to be used for political ends. So I think this is an interesting development. And that's all I have for that. Christian, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, we're kind of going over, so I don't want to take too long. But generally speaking, we see this trend across the globe is the politicization and the agendification of the monetary system as if they haven't created enough problems. They want to be in charge of everything. Right. They want to be in charge of the water that you get, the electricity that you get, who you pay, who you hire, all of the above. They have an agenda and they want to try to implement it. So, you know, I think the trend is grab and control, land grab for power. That's what these institutions are doing. It's something that if you read The Sovereign Individual, these large institutions at this point in history, they necessitate this. This is how they continue to expand and they want to expand. That's all they can do. And we are the victims of that. And thankfully, again, there's technology like Bitcoin that helps us defend against that. That is the macro trend. So you can read through the tea leaves, but that is what's happening when you zoom out. So that's what we're trying to educate you about. And again, look at the politicians that work for the government. They're trying to land and expand their agenda via these politicized means and via controlling the monetary policy and who controls that or thinks that they control that or at least has the authority to mess with it. And they're not trying to shy away. They want monetary policy to fit their agenda because they think their agenda is going to be good for the planet or whatever. So it is what it is. And we need to fight it. That's what we got to do.
So yeah, I just have some more stuff on going from the Fed. We spent a bunch of time right there on the Fed. And now I wanted to talk about China real quick, the China PMI. Their PMI is the Purchasing Managers Index. So they go out there and survey all of the people, purchasing managers in the economy, and see if they're expanding, staying neutral, or contracting their business. And so in a big news just dropped yesterday, China is back in the negative on the non-manufacturing. So their retail side, they are going back in the negative, and they are the lowest since last February in the manufacturing sector. So they are having really contracting times in their economy over there in China. And as the credit impulse in China goes, usually the rest of the globe kind of follows. I could screen share that, but I don't think that's necessary. And that's it, man. That's all I have for the rest of the world.
I mean, I definitely want to chat about like Afghanistan and what we're seeing there, just because I want to zoom out, guys. I want to talk about the big picture, which is we've seen the war on drugs and plants. We've seen the war on terrorism, ideology, any sort of government that doesn't fit what our government likes, the war on communism, war on ideas, if you will. And now, you know, we're starting to see the war on germs. So again, these governments are trying to expand. These entities are trying to expand all of their wars, all of their initiatives. that they're justifying this expansion have turned into disaster. And I'm sure as someone who served in the military, Ansel, you know what went into things in operations like Afghanistan. And what are the results? What are the results? You know, it sounds like it's a clown world that we gave all these vehicles and aircrafts to them with keys. Like, why can they even operate this stuff, right? Like, it's just absolutely bonkers. How many Americans are in prison for nonviolent drug crimes, ruining their lives, ruining their children's lives, ruining their children's children's lives, creating negative culture for generations? Like, what is the outcome of all of this? What is the outcome of Mr. Jerome Powell and Mrs. AOC, you know, and all of their tinkering? You need to ask yourselves these questions. And then when you see Bitcoin, that's why you see Ansel and I so encouraged by it and so excited by it, because it's pretty much a no more. Enough is enough with this. If we can get enough people saying that, you know, maybe we can live in a world that doesn't have to have the suffering that's caused by effectively these crazy people and these horrible incentive structures.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm more in the cyclical camp. Like, I think that the world that we see today with all the stuff going on in Afghanistan, all of the, you know, incarceration rates in the United States, and some people say it's like a cultural decline of the West, things like that. I think that it is mainly due to credit-based money. It's due to the money, right? But this happens in a cycle, just like Austrians will tell you, it's a business cycle. But Ray Dalio has done work on these long-term debt cycles and how that plays out. Any sort of cyclical model that you're looking at is coming up either right now or in the next 5 to 10 years of a major shift, you know, fourth turning, the Ray Dalio long-term cycle, any sort of boom bust cycle that you look at. So I think it's less serious. What happened in Afghanistan? One, I don't think it was an accident. I think they left that stuff over there on purpose because geopolitically they want to cause chaos in Central Asia. Maybe not everybody knew that that was the plan, but there were some people that thought, hey, we're just going to leave a bunch of weapons over here so the Taliban can actually increase costs for other people in Central Asia, specifically their neighbors. You know, they have a border with China and they have a border with former Soviet republics where Russia has a big influence. They have a border with Iran. So there's a lot of different players over there that maybe the U.S. just wants to get out in kind of a chaotic fashion and stir up as much trouble as possible to cause as much expense to our quote unquote rivals in the world. I don't know, but that would be much more likely in my mind than to have this happen as incompetently as it has. So who knows what's all going on, but overall, I think it's a cyclical pattern and where the fiat system is breaking down, the credit bubble is bursting globally, and it's perfect timing with Bitcoin to come in here and pick up the pieces.
Yeah, I think incredibly, incredibly well said. Again, no one here is a full expert, right? We're just trying to understand. Bitcoin's a tool to help us understand better. And that's why we're advocating for it, because these are complex things. And all these central planners are just mucking it up. They have ulterior motives. Even if what you're saying about Afghanistan is correct, why should we trust them? Why do they have in our interests, right? So we dissect all of that here on FedWatch. So subscribe, find us at Bitcoin Magazine, find us on Twitter at CK_Snarks, at Ansel Lindner. And until next time, give us those likes, give us those reviews. Let's pump up the numbers, guys. Let's pump it up. Share, please.